Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who met his wife while training for the 400 meters in Seattle and is eating gluten-free while lusting after bread, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, hope you are having a fantastic week, and today we are doing another throwback episode. This is, again, another one of the earliest episodes that I ever did. This is an interview with the author Dennis Hirsch, and in this interview today, you are going to be learning about the one critical thing that every physician should know about contracts. We're going to talk about how to understand the huge differences between productivity models and which productivity model is the worst. And then finally, you're going to learn what is negotiable and what is not negotiable in your contract. And so with that, here is the episode with Dennis Hirsch.
My name is Dave Denniston. Welcome to my latest podcast, The Freedom Formula for Physicians. Well, today we're going to be focusing on physician employment contracts. One of my latest quests has been to connect and network with other authors that help physicians every day. And as many of you know, right now, it's an incredible time of the year for many residents and fellows. As a matter of fact, I'm sure many of you are being wined and dined like free agents of sports teams as you consider inking this contract in front of you that they want you to sign. And as you have this in front of you, maybe you're wondering, is this the best I can get? Am I leaving money on the table? What are the pitfalls that other physicians have fallen into? Well, and who can I have review my contract? What can they do for me to get me the best possible deal? Well, today we're going to be chatting with Dennis Hirsch. He is the author of The Final Hurdle, A Physician's Guide to Negotiating a Fair Employment Agreement. Well, besides being an author, Dennis has been a practicing attorney since 1982. So he's seen a lot, probably every kind of contract you can imagine. And he's been representing physicians in contracts since 1992. And he's a contributing editor to the Physicians News Digest. He's published several articles to physicians' contractual matters. And in addition to all that, he lectures frequently at residency and fellowship programs, has even spoken at events sponsored by the Pennsylvania Medical Society, the Milton Hershey Medical Center, the Pennsylvania Society of Cardiology, and much more. And as part of his service to physicians, he's founded the Physician Prosperity Program, which is the nation's premier contract review and negotiating service. And as I mentioned, he is an author. I have no idea how he has the time to do all of this and the time he has, but I personally really enjoyed his book. I learned a lot from it, and I think you will too. Well, welcome, Dennis.
Great to be here, Dave.
All right. Well, let's kick this off. Well, tell us a bit about yourself. You started off your journey as an attorney, focusing on a wide spectrum of cases. And now you focus on physicians. So tell us, why did you choose this focus, and how did you transition over time?
Well, as you mentioned, I was doing a lot. I was predominantly a tax lawyer. I was a tax manager at Coopers & Lybrand, which is now PricewaterhouseCooper. And then when I set up my law firm, I was representing a lot of preferred provider organizations. And I was working with the Pennsylvania Medical Society, among a lot of other groups, to set up physician organizations. And the idea was we'd set them up and then have them operate their own PPOs. And I always enjoyed working with physicians. But my focus kind of changed when my daughter, Rachel, was born. She was born with, we now know, DeGeorge syndrome, but her major problem was truncus arteriosus. And her first year and a half, we probably spent more than half our time in the hospital, mostly Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And one night in particular, I'll never forget, the critical care doc and the cardiology fellow literally spent the night glued at her bed. I think the cardiology fellow went out at one moment and grabbed a salad, and so he was gone for maybe 20 minutes. The critical care doc was there constantly, never left the bedside, and obviously doing every trick in the book and a few that probably weren't in the book to save her. And pretty much that night, I decided that one way or another, I was going to try and figure out a way to pay him back. And I don't think what I do is really an adequate payback for Rachel's life, but it's a start.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, we go through these life events, and they change us, and the focus changes. So tell us more about, as you started working with docs and you're wanting to pay it back a little bit, how does your practice evolved over the years?
Well, in a lot of ways, I have traditionally represented private practice physicians. And as I tell people, in a large sense, that is the equivalent of being a veterinarian and specializing in endangered species. the practices are just going away. So I love to work with private practices, and I really think that is the best medicine. I think when doctors have more control, I think medicine is better. But I became more and more aware of doctors coming into the practices and leaving hospitals or leaving fellowships, and I really started to realize how many of them were signing the piece of paper that was handed to them. It was clear to me that conventional wisdom was that this is carved in stone, and you are given it, and if you don't sign it as is, we're going to go find somebody else. And I've learned over the years, physicians really don't seem to know how valuable they are, that there aren't usually 50 physicians vying for that spot. If the employer has spent the time and culled through the resumes and done some interviews and made you an offer, they're very interested in having you there. They've invested a lot of time and a precious physician time and probably a lot of money. So it was frustrating for me to find out all these doctors that were coming to me on contract renewals and having their contracts reviewed, because they're sitting around and they're talking to people and they say, you know, I hate that we have to do that. And their colleague will say, well, I don't have to do that. And a sort of a light bulb comes on. And says, wait a minute, that's in the standard contract. And so I became aware that really when physicians are getting out of training, that first contract can have such an impact on their lives that I kind of decided I could probably do the most for the practice of medicine or for physicians if I really started focusing on people coming out of training. And
well,
that was sort of the impetus for the book.
Well, what I find about working with docs in the financial planning world is they early in their career, they tend to be trusting. Mm-hmm. And perhaps too much so, because they are bright, they are super busy, and they just don't have the time to take care of this stuff. I mean, I kind of think of it as a deer in the headlights look. As many of these residents, as they're entering this last year of practice, and they're finally like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be able to finally make some money and pay off some debt, and they're overwhelmed with responsibilities, and they're low man on the totem pole, and can't find the time to focus on this stuff. And I think what happens, they just did a sign the dotted line because they're so excited about it, but perhaps
you can't blame them. I mean, they've been making, you know, subsistence wages, and suddenly, you know, you're signing a contract 5, 6, 7 times what you're making now. It sounds great. You know, what's not to like about it? What do I have to read? What'd you say that salary was? Okay, where do I
right.
sign? I mean,
right.
You know, that's and they don't realize just sometimes what they're getting themselves into.
Well, and I think what's great about your book and the final hurdle is, I often talk about this with clients that their initial contract talks so much about their benefits, and you focus so much on that bottom line number of compensation. Well, how are they going to get paid? And it seems really simple, and their salary, and well, there's this productivity bonus that maybe I could get. And what I found in your book, perhaps, that there's not enough time that's spent on understanding how this productivity measure can vary so much from one opportunity to another. And one of the comparisons that I thought was really intriguing is this relationship between billings, collections, and RVUs. So tell us a little bit more about that. What's going on with those three things?
Well, the frustrating thing for me is when pay you based upon billings, what that means generally is we will look at the bills that are sent out and we'll have a certain number, and if you exceed that number, we'll give you some percentage of what exceeds. So it kind of looks at what the bill going out was rather than how much money we made on it. So in some senses, mm-hmm. that's sort of good. If you're dealing with an indigent patient, your billings are going to be the same as if you were dealing for a patient with a Cadillac health plan. So in a sense, that's good. I also see, and it's actually more common than billings, is collections. Collections are kind of bad in a hospital setting because of all the years that hospitals have been employing physicians, it seems none of them have really learned how to bill for physician services. So if you're based on collections, you are totally at the mercy of the hospital's billing department. And as I said, that is not necessarily doing good billing. So if the money's not coming in, then your bonus, and it should always be bonus, by the way. I absolutely think a new physician should never be paid strictly on productivity because you don't have control over the patients that are going to present. You know, doctors seem to think productivity's fine. I'll work hard, and I don't mind working hard, so if I'm not concerned, but you can't work hard if no patients are presenting, and that's not under your control.
Well, then collections, I mean, it's delay, right? I mean, it could be
sometimes they're just not diligent. Most private practices will be generating bills the next day, sometimes that day, as you know, morning's bills are being submitted electronically in the afternoon. Certainly by the next day they're submitted. Hospitals, you know, it seems like they batch it. And then if Joe in billing is off for vacation, it doesn't go in. And then it seems like they have horrible follow-up. I mean, most private practices, if they're not paid in 30 days, are going to resubmit that bill. And it just seems like hospitals don't. So it's shocking to me that after all these years, it seems like they still haven't learned how to bill for physician services. So collections is kind of scary for me.
Well, what
the
about...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what about RVUs? You know, they're coming up more and more, and you make a point in the book that RVUs can be great in that it treats all patient encounters the same, regardless of how the patient pays, whether it's insurance or private or Medicare or now the ACA, yet it also has a big disadvantage, extras that are outside of patient care.
Right, and they've done a very thorough job. Pretty much anything that has a CPT code attached, anything you do treating a patient, there's going to be a WRVU for. What there isn't going to be a WRVU for is department meetings. A lot of times part of your job, especially if it's a small department, part of your job description will be helping with the budget. There's no budget WRVU, attending medical staff meetings. A lot of times marketing is expected. You know, again, there's no marketing WRVU. So you just have to be aware that to say, okay, sure, I'll do WRVUs. And yes, it is more fair. Indigent patients, the same WRVU. That's great. But just be aware that the hospital, if that's the case, you have to be very aware of what other duties are being assigned, and you have to realize that that's not going to generate WRVUs. So that, you know, if you're thinking about, again, the thing that I think, I won't say trick, but misleads a lot of physicians is they think of productivity means working hard, and I am willing to work hard, and therefore productivity compensation will be great. But these are the things, you know, again, that you don't take into consideration. And you can be working hard and not getting paid.
Well, then what about those physicians that are in the academic setting, right? Now, on top of those things you just mentioned, they're also helping out with the residents and the fellows and teaching and doing all those things.
That's right. And again, there's no WRVUs for any of that. So, and I've seen physicians coming out of training and basically being the first in that specialty, usually subspecialty, in the hospital, and
wow.
they're going to be the head of the department now.
Because
it's, the department is them. But that means, you know, credentialing issues and everything else. Even though they're the only ones, the hospital needs to develop appropriate credentialing, and all that goes through, you know, the new head of the department. And again, you know, there's no WRVUs for any of that. So sometimes the administrative work is really will take physicians by surprise. And again, there's no problem with doing that work. It's just that that's why a salary is there. There should be some. You should be paid for what you do.
So with the bonuses and getting paid adequately, how do you think docs are getting seduced by these sirens of pay?
Well, I think the issue is you didn't get through training by being lazy. You know, you're used to working very hard, working very long hours. You know you're very smart. And so docs tend to look at it and say, okay, the salary's not so great, but if I max out on the bonus, I will be doing, you know, 90th percentile of MGMA. It's great. And since I work so hard, I know what I'm going to get is that base salary plus the maximum bonus. And the problem is they may very well be working very hard, but all these things come in, you know, they may not be getting paid for what they're doing is one issue. And the second issue is, as good as you are, you aren't doing anything to generate income unless there's a patient that you're involved
That's right.
with. And I've seen, you know, hospitals come in and say, we want to build up this department. We have four docs right now. We're going to hire four more.
Yeah.
Well, guess what happens to pretty much the original four that were on productivity compensation? It's not that they've just all decided it's a lifestyle practice, but in fact, you know, their patient volume plummets, and to the extent their income is tied to productivity through no fault of their own, their compensation plummets.
And especially when you don't have your name out there yet, and you're just trying to get going. I mean, that could be a cruddy situation.
Yeah, it really is. Well, and especially since, let's face it, most physicians, when you come in, I call up for my doctor's office and say, I want to see Dr. Smith. And they'll say, well, Dr. Smith can't see you for 3.5 weeks, but our new doctor can see you Wednesday, you know. And so that's how you get, you know, that's how you first meet the patient. Well, the problem is, and, you know, in that scenario I was talking about, where you double the staff size, suddenly if I call in and want to see Dr. Smith, he's going to be available Wednesday. So, he's the one I'm seeing. I have no reason to see the new physician. And so the new physicians tend to get it even worse than the established physicians.
Well, let's just back up a second. I just want to think back to this moment where doctors have residents, fellows, they've gotten their contract in hand now, and they're looking at it and they're saying, gosh, I mean, this seems pretty set. It's like it's written in stone. Can you talk a little bit about what you can negotiate in these contracts versus what can you not negotiate? What is non-negotiable?
And honestly, I mean, it's going to vary from place to place, but I've been doing this now for well over 25 years, and I couldn't tell you how many hundreds of these I've done, and I have never had a contract where the employer came back and said, we will not make any of your changes. We will not bend on anything. So pretty much everything is negotiable, but for a given employer, you don't know what it is. So usually what I do when I review a contract is I make suggestions that if they accepted each and every one of these, you would have pretty much a perfect contract. Now, as you can imagine, I was going to say that never happens. Actually, it was the weirdest thing. 2 weeks ago, the CEO of the hospital sat down with my client, went right through the four-page letter, bullet by bullet, and gave him every single one.
But wow.
In 25 years, that's never happened, and it'll probably happen again in 25 years. So people shouldn't expect that to happen. But what generally happens is they give a whole lot of those points completely. Some they'll say that's not negotiable at all, and there'll be some that they'll say, well, we'll meet you halfway on. So, but I can't really say this one is always non-negotiable because it just doesn't work that way. It's each one has, it seems, has different things. And I think some of it is pain points. If if they just had, you know, the star physician leave on and compete against them because of a loophole in their covenant not to compete, suddenly they're going to have, you know, a 15-page covenant not to compete, and they won't change that at all. Whereas, you know, whatever they've been burned on, they tend to not negotiate. But so as you can imagine, that varies from employer to employer.
Well, and I find from my financial planning world that, you know, there's certain things that employers have to have the same for everybody, like your 401k match, like the amount of disability they offer to employees. But
that's
when
well, federally qualified plans, yes, they can't, you know, it's to get a tax deduction, it's set up that you don't come into the 401k for a year. They can't say, except you're great, so you can come in a month. You're right. Those federally qualified plans, tax qualified plans, are more or less carved in stone. So a lot of the third party benefits are, but for instance, vacation isn't provided by a third party. CME
moving
allowance,
expenses.
Right? Signing bonus, you know, all those things. Even call schedule. A lot of times I've seen instances where, and because I've done a lot of them, sometimes I've negotiated one for the same hospital, and you think everybody gets the same, but in fact, you know, then I get something and the new physician has a more strenuous call requirement, or something that simply says call will be established by the employer, period. Whereas I know other physicians in the department are, you know, have a little more flexibility. So there really is very few things that can't be negotiated. The issue is you just never know what for a given employer it's going to be. So I always ask for everything. Again, I would do a 3 or 4 page letter with bullet points of every section, and if they gave you every one of those, you would have pretty much the perfect contract. And from their perspective, it would be a lousy contract. So, you know, there's going to be a good, you know, there's going to be some give and take, but you just never know. I never tell, I've learned over the years that a lot of physicians will take a review letter and summarize it. They'll go through and say, these first 5 points, I don't care about that. Oh, that's a deal breaker. Hmm. And, I don't care about this or this or this or this. That's a deal breaker. And then they'll go to the hospital and say, I've got 4 things I want. Well, if you think about it, if you and I are negotiating and you give me 2 of the 4 points that I said there was 4 things that are important to me and you gave me 2, as far as you're concerned, you met me halfway. So now I should give 2 up because that's only fair, you know? I mean, you met me halfway.
Yeah, sure.
So it's very different to hand a 4-page letter with all the bullet points and then end up saying, no, you know, I'll give you this one, I'll give you that one, I'll give you this one. No, this give on this one. This is critical. It just seems like you're being more fair than to go in and say, I have 4 points, and each one of them is a deal breaker. You know,
so
I won't bend
open-minded. Be open-minded.
Right. But again, I think don't say, well, this is not important, so I'm not going to ask for it. You know, I think there's a concept of bargaining chips, and, you know, putting the word reasonable before a requirement. Are you going to lose sleep if they don't do that? No. But on the other hand, that's something you can say, okay, you know, you don't have to do that. There again, but if I'm going to insist on this one, I don't seem like I'm being unreasonable now.
That's good. Good advice. Now we're running out of time a little bit, and there's so much I want to talk about, but I don't think we have time to talk about all of it. I think it'd be helpful for a lot of residents and fellows to think about typical restrictions in contracts. Like, you talk about the location, the physical restrictions that often come, as well as the time and restrictions that come within the employment agreement. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you're talking about covenants not to compete that says when you leave, you won't compete with me, which is in a sense fair. You were a new physician. You came in here. We basically gave you the referral sources or we turned the patients over. So it's not fair for you to walk across the street and set up your own practice and take those from us.
Sure.
I don't think anybody would say, yes, that's perfectly fair. So they'll have a covenant not to compete. And that will basically say there's something you can't do within a given radius for a given period of time. The something is very critical. I see so many that say you will not practice medicine in the given radius.
Wow.
What you should be prohibited from doing is opening up a new office within the prohibited radius, not practicing medicine. So if you're a primary care doc, you should still be able, or any kind of doc, you should still be able to see patients in the hospital. You just can't have, if you were a hospital employee, you just can't have your office across the street from the hospital. But very commonly, it's a prohibition against practicing medicine.
Well, I got to think about many surgeons. They're not located just in one place when they're working for, let's say, a different hospital system. They might end up having to move from hospital to hospital in order to do the surgeries.
Right, right. And again, and they ought to, and I don't know why hospitals do this, frankly. They should be delighted that you're admitting patients to their hospital, even though you're not working with them anymore. So, you know, they should be delighted, but they don't. They say you can't practice medicine. And like I said, it should be your office location. But the two things are the radius and the time period. The radius, I usually try to not get more than a 5-mile radius in an urban area. Now, you know, if you're in the wilds in Alaska where you drive 3 hours for groceries, then obviously a 5-mile radius is not reasonable. It can expand, you know, in the country. But 5 miles is where I start for urban and suburban. And the time period, I always, the thing I tell people is focus on the radius rather than the time period. If you're not seeing patients for 1 year, you're as much out of the market as if you can't see patients for 2 years. So I believe it should be 1 year, 5-mile radius, but I'm a lot more willing to give on the time period than I am the radius.
Well, that's understandable, and I think it's all about reasonable expectations, right? You know, I think
Exactly. Someone
says a 20-mile radius, that just is nuts. That could be
well,
a whole
it is unless
area.
You're in, you know, again, unless you're used to driving 20 miles for groceries. You know, if you're in Montana or something on a ranch in Montana, then it may be not so unreasonable.
We did a road trip this last summer all the way through Montana. I'm just picturing those blue open skies. And
Yeah,
that could easily happen. Well, there's so much in the book that we simply don't have time to cover here today. And do you have any other just thoughts on contracts that you think folks should be aware of or areas that we didn't have the time to cover today that you want to touch on?
Well, I just think you have to realize that there's no free lunch. So if you're getting a super salary, you should assume that they're going to expect super productivity. So you have to evaluate contracts on the totality, not just one thing. There could be if in the same town two places offer you a contract and one is significantly more money, you can pretty much expect that they're going to expect you to work a lot harder, which may be fine for you. But you just have to know that it's a totality. It's you don't look at the compensation and say that's what makes it best. And I think the biggest thing to remember is there is no such thing as the standard contract. Every employer is willing to bend a little, some more than others, but every contract's willing to bend. So you really have to do your best to get the best deal that you can.
Well, I think that sounds totally fair, and we've run out of time here, and I just want to thank you so much for being with us. If people have more questions, how can they get in contact with you, and also with your book, The Final Hurdle, where can they pick up a copy of it?
Well, probably the easiest way, most convenient for them, to get a hold of me would be to fill out, there's a contact form on my website, which is at pahealthlaw.com. My phone number is 866-DOC-LAW-1, and the book is available pretty much everywhere. It's at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other places, but you can find out about it at the book's website, which is thefinalhurdle.com.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again so much, Dennis, and we'll be in touch. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about partnerships next time.
That sounds great. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, everybody, enjoy. And this is Dave at this Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. If you have any other questions or want to participate, make sure to subscribe to this particular podcast or email me, Dave at daviddeniston.com with any questions. Enjoy. Have a good one.